Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, and welcome back to American Biography, a member of the Agora Podcast Network. This is The Life of John Marshall, Episode 16, XYZ, Part 2. This is also American Biography's one-year birthday spectacular. It's our podiversary, and joining me today to celebrate is the host of When Diplomacy Fails and PhD candidate, hashtag Zach to Cambridge, the one, the only, Zach Twomley. Zach, welcome to American Biography, and thanks for coming by to class up the place.
Yay, thanks for having me, and happy birthday, American Biography.
Well, we're very happy to have you. And just as a reminder to the listeners, last episode we discussed the frankly ridiculous state of affairs between the three-person American diplomatic mission to Paris over the winter of 1797 to 1798. Of which Marshall was a part, and so was the famous French foreign minister, Talleyrand. On this show, I endeavor to try to talk about history through the lens of the podcast subject. But this is a really crowded hour in the history of the world surrounding the French Revolution, and to say that there's a lot happening internationally and domestically in the United States over the course of the last several episodes I've covered is really an understatement. So what I was hoping to do today, with Zach's expert help, was to endeavor to fill in some of those gaps in what's been happening in the wider world, and the events that are shaping the context in which John Marshall's life and career is unfolding. So, I guess right now to start with, when we look at, you know, what happened in my last episode in the XYZ affair, in the diplomatic mission to Paris, I was wondering, Zach, if you would be able to walk us through a little bit what was going on. It was obviously in the midst of the wars of the First Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
Can you maybe give us some background about what's going on there and how is it affecting France?
Okay, well, I think we'll come back to this later, but the general trend in the way that the French behave, I think they get more and more kind of haughty, I suppose is the right term, as their successes in the War of the First Coalition get better and better. I mean, the War of the First Coalition lasts from about 1792 to about 1797 or so, because that's after that point, after about October 1797, the French and the British are pretty much just at each other's throats alone until the peace breaks down, and then we're back to the Second and Third Coalitions, etc., etc. So kind of the general trend, this will probably sound familiar to most people, but it's good to kind of recap anyway and put the whole XYZ affair in context. The French Republic initially suffer a great series of defeats, and they get pushed very far back in the first few months of 1792 and 3. And it's not until April and August 1793 that two really important things happen. The first of these in April, the Committee of Public Safety is created in April 1793, and that basically it kind of, it's the first really concrete kind of system of government that is really set up in France at the time, insofar as it actually helps the French administration through its various iterations actually deal with some kind of power. And their first real act in using this kind of and wielding this kind of power is to issue the Order of Levée en masse, which basically means that every male from 18 to 25, though practically they roped in people much older than that, was basically a soldier from this point on. And this, while it might sound not too revolutionary now, was incredibly revolutionary in that time. And as a result, you had armies that were far, far stronger and far larger in numbers than anyone elsewhere in Europe was used to seeing. And it helped France really achieve a huge number of successes and pretty much advance further than France had ever reached, even in the times of Louis XIV or before that. So really, this is what's called, I think, this is why French people see this time today as really the glory era of France, because within the space of a few years, by the end of what this is, by the end of this, the first coalition war, France had basically marched its armies all around Europe and had achieved a great series of successes in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, in Italy, and in Austria, of course, as well. They'd achieved such successes that their original enemies of the Dutch, the Austrians, the Prussians had all been defeated militarily and convincingly. And France now possessed significant territories and had created incredibly diverse satellite states in northern Italy, in the Netherlands, which was now the Batavian Republic. Austria had ceded the Austrian Netherlands to them, so they basically owned all of Belgium now. And the Swiss were also roped into the field as well. So you had what's basically this ring of security around the French. And to the south was the Spanish, but the Spanish, as of yet, weren't as involved in the whole issue as the rest of Europe was and Britain. But I'm sure that'll come up later on. Anyway, The whole way the war kind of plays into our story of the XYZ affair is by the time the US decides to send its kind of commission over in early 1797, I'm going to make that mistake a lot because I'm talking about the 1800s so much in my own podcast. By the time the US decides to send its own kind of commission over to sort of make itself felt and sort of ease some of the problems that the US and France are going through at this point, by the time it makes the decision to do that, France has not yet achieved the full extent of its victories. The peace treaty of Campo Formio, which would basically kind of be the cherry on top of the French successes, which would be the Austrian handing over of the Austrian Netherlands and France pretty much being supreme in Europe apart from Britain, that would not happen until October. And as we know from Thomas's episode last time, the US and the French were kind of dealing with each other before that. So I think you're bound to notice a pretty distinct change in tone once the French begin to realize, hold on a minute, we're doing pretty well for ourselves here.
Oh, definitely. They I think it was X, but it could have been Y. Literally through that in the delegate's face. They showed up to rattle the saber, basically, and say, you guys have been dragging your feet. It's time to shape up, because we've just defeated Austria. Well, yeah. There was obviously very, very high confidence that they would be able to deal with Britain, now isolated, mm-hmm. In short order, and they were confident in basically threatening the United States comply now, like the Batavian Republic, like some satellite republic that they were dealing with in Europe.
Yeah. I would like to ask a question about that. Do you think, I mean, we know at this stage the United States is a very young nation. Do you think that in French eyes, if you're looking at this from the French perspective, do you think that that certainly made the French see the United States in a certain way that maybe they thought even before the Treaty of Campo Formio had been signed in October 1797, and before the French thought then that they were militarily supreme, do you think before then that kind of tone of arrogance that was within the French, do you think that came from dealing with a country like the United States that they saw maybe is culturally inferior because of its youth?
Oh, I think absolutely. You know, I think they had already had a brief meeting with Talleyrand when they arrived earlier in 1797 and had met X and Y already before Campo Formio. And they were already being treated rather shabbily and being extorted for deucers to line Talleyrand and the Directory's pockets. I think Talleyrand was certainly savvy enough to know that the United States, where he'd lived for several years, while avoiding the Terror, didn't pose a threat to France. We really didn't have much in the way of a navy at all. And he, I think, was fairly confident that domestically the United States was divided and that there was a very strong, quote, French party, end quote, in the United States that would derail any real attempts, to effectively try to fight France if it came down to it. And I think that goes back quite a ways, actually, to the Washington administration.
Right.
Back to 1793, really, when Washington sees that the United States is being caught in between the wars of the French Revolution, between Britain and France, particularly, on the high seas of the Atlantic, and declares neutrality. Mm-hmm. That gets a lot of domestic pushback. His popularity is able to sustain, through his declaration of neutrality. But when he has to send John Jay to Britain to negotiate the Jay Treaty, he does come under heavy and increasingly heavy fire in the Republican press. Jefferson doesn't resign directly because of the Jay Treaty, but he does resign before it's negotiated. And his replacement is another Virginian who I've talked about, Edmund Randolph, who ends up resigning while the treaty's in Washington's hands, basically, because it's discovered that he's been writing rather indiscreet letters to the French minister, Joseph Fossett, declaring that the Federalist Party is going to try to take over, the Republic and end the American Republic. And of course, the British intercept one of his letters to Fossé's, and I cannot pronounce French names for the life of me, so I apologize to anyone who's
me
listening.
Me neither.
and turn it over to the United States, because that's what Britain does. And Washington confronts him with his letters, and Randolph resigns. And that's significant because that actually marks a turn in the Washington administration, where he'd previously been or tried to be above politics. He begins to definitely align less with the Jeffersonian Republicans and much more with the Hamiltonian Federalists at this point. And I think that turn in the government drives a lot more domestically than is always given credit for, because that's going to spill over into the Adams administration, where Adams keeps Washington's cabinet almost in its entirety.
Right. So what another unscripted exclusive question I have to ask you about the Jay Treaty in particular. Do you think that was a sensible kind of move in a case where Britain and the United States obviously had fought before, and since this is before the War of 1812, they will fight again? So did it initially surprise you before you knew about this? And maybe some of our other listeners might be able to relate to this as well, to discover that before the War of 1812 and a little bit after the War of Independence, the British and Americans were actually trying to sort out some of their issues, and actually it looked like America might drift into a war with its former friend France. Did that surprise you?
It didn't surprise me, because I'm a man of learning and scholarship.
Very patronizing. I like it.
I guess actually it's not surprising if you think about it, because based on the Treaty of Paris, 1783, Britain had refused to comply with a lot of the terms. It hadn't abandoned the Western forts in the Ohio River Valley that it had promised to. Ostensibly, this had to deal with the large amount of outstanding debt United States citizens owed British bankers and citizens.
Right.
But Britain just didn't respect the United States, and to some extent, why should it worry about the United States? Just as we said, Talleyrand didn't, because the United States didn't have an effective navy.
Yeah.
You know, Britain wasn't going to reinvade the United States at this point, but it didn't have to. It had the greatest navy in the world. It could do whatever it wanted to the United States on the high seas, and it did. You mentioned the War of 1812. One of the issues is going to be impressment of American sailors. Well, that's happening now. You know, that's happening here in the late 1790s.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's one of the issues on the table. It dies down, but it doesn't go away entirely. So was the Jay Treaty necessary? It was necessary, because one of the few things after the Revolutionary War that Americans could use to identify what it was to be an American is being against the British.
Yeah.
You know, they almost define themselves negatively. It's their animosity to the British, their old enemy. So the population in the United States generally is very supportive of the French. And it's only the higher level view in the Washington administration that can really objectively look at this and say, we can't do this. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
One of the favorite hobby horses of the Republicans in international diplomacy is this belief that, you know, Americans can essentially boycott anything going on in Europe economically. And Europe is so dependent on American goods that we can change behaviors. This is particularly strong with Jefferson. And when you see later when these issues persist into his administration, he'll have his embargo, his completely failed embargo, where he says, all right, we're just not trading with Britain or France. And that doesn't work out so hot, because they don't need the United States as much as the Republicans think they do. So the Republicans are viewing this situation through highly ideological eyes, where Washington is being a bit more of a pragmatist and saying, well, not only do we need neutrality, and he proclaims neutrality, but we need to get on better terms with Britain, because most of our trade at this point is with Britain. Anything we have going on with France is pretty much blockaded. So they're not going to be a great trading partner from this point. You know, we're not going to expressly help anybody.
Yeah.
But we definitely have to. We're in a position where France couldn't help us if they wanted to on the high seas.
Yeah.
So basically what the Jay Treaty does, it's you could call it a capitulation to the British. We basically had to accept what the British said neutral rights were.
Right.
You know, we weren't calling the tune. We were dead set on staying out of it, and part of staying out of it was accepting that we had to give the British most favorable nation trading status.
Right.
Which did seem to fly in the face of our 1788 commitment to the French, but at the same time, we could say, well, that treaty wasn't with the French Republic. That was with a different government.
That's true. Yeah, that's a handy technicality there. Another thing to consider as well is just even the fact alone that when the Jay Treaty was signed, France was not having a very good time of things in the European continent. I mean, as I opened the monologue I opened with there, the fact that France was basically losing on all fronts, and it had been pushed back in as many theaters as one could be pushed back in, and it did not look very good for Paris. So to say, maybe you could even argue in one sense, like you alluded to the fact even that France was essentially blockaded at this stage. So why would the Americans think that an equivalent of the Jay Treaty with France was a good idea? I mean, why not negotiate with the winning power, or at least the power that looked the strongest at the moment? So, yeah, I guess when you put it that way, it does make sense.
I think so, definitely. It's an example of that, clear-eyed American diplomacy.
But
I think in this case it was. It was a very pragmatic view of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And an evaluation of what the interests of the United States were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And really, that's what an elected official is tasked with doing.
Sure.
Like, Washington's not the president of, Western diplomatic relations. He was the president of the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, well, continuing on with that trend, when Americans finally land in France in early 1797 to kind of negotiate a better deal with the French, really, I suppose you could say, and ease the tensions that are surrounding the French seizure of American ships and, of course, the American desire to remain neutral as much as is possible. You alluded to the fact that in your podcast episode before this one that the fact that France was kind of unstable might have set these US delegates on edge. Do you think that there was a bit of a culture shock when they arrived?
I think there was a major culture shock when they arrived. I don't think that they expected to be treated so shabbily.
Yeah.
I don't think they expected, and I think Pinckney even says in a quote that I put in my last episode, is like, we didn't expect this. We had no idea you guys were going to ask us for money, to which I think X replies, any American in Paris could have told you this, which I thought was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to wonder a bit, because as I look at this, and this is really a low point, I think, for Thomas Jefferson and the Jeffersonian Republicans. James Monroe had been the ambassador stationed in Paris, and he had been recalled in 1796 for basically bad-mouthing the Jay Treaty, which was a standard party line, essentially.
Yeah.
For Republicans, both domestically and apparently abroad. So I think Jefferson bears a lot of responsibility for setting up a situation where there is this expectation that the Federalists were going to be toppled. And if the French government just played for time, essentially, basically with Jefferson's elevation, which he was held up for president in 1796, he didn't win, John Adams did. But if they held out and the Republicans came to power, they were going to get a sweetheart deal.
Do you think that the deal that the French expected revolved around the antagonism that the Republicans felt towards Britain? Or do you think it was a different motive maybe that they were expecting?
I think it was evolving in the French mind. At the outset, I think they certainly thought a Jefferson administration would ally the United States with French against Britain.
Yeah.
After Campo Formio, I kind of get the feeling that it went from alliance to bringing the United States within the domination of the French sphere.
Yeah, it does kind of seem that way, all right, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely had a flavor, that flavor to me when I'm reading about it.
Yeah, I want to change tax a little bit and just talk a bit about the practice that so shocked the Americans, and we can talk a bit about this, how this played into the whole culture shock of the French kind of practice of douceur, or basically accepting bribes for means of lubricating the practice of diplomacy.
Yeah, I would definitely, because as I mentioned to you earlier, I've read a bit about Benjamin Franklin, and I don't see this being a factor when he's over there in the 1780s. Maybe that's because he's a rock star, and maybe his currency is a celebrity.
Sure.
But yeah, if you have any insight into what this is all about, please.
Well, I'll give my best, but from what I've kind of taken from it, a lot of it has to do with the simple facts on the ground. It was by no means a kind of ideological shift that, oh, anyone who wants to do diplomacy has to pay us money. It was more the case of necessity that the French, after fighting a series of wars against the great powers in Europe at the time, were badly, badly in need of money. And they believed that America, having been outside of this war, would come to possess, well, I suppose, an advantageous economic position, at least insofar as they'd be able to provide a certain level of funds that the French would otherwise not be able to have access to. And perhaps this comes, like, perhaps this makes sense if we think about it in terms of the kind of French arrogance, I suppose you could call it, that maybe the French thought they were entitled to ask for bribes and ask for money to kind of grease the wheels. I mean, it was by no means a brand new invention. I'm sure before even recorded times, countries had have to buy their way into kind of the diplomatic circles. But I think the reason why it stuck in the Americans' craw so much is because of the condescending way that the French did it. Not even the fact that they did it, because that was obviously striking in itself for the Americans, but the fact that they did it with such a sense of like, we want to talk to us and we need money, so you will give us money and then we will talk to you. There didn't seem to be a middle ground, and I think that's really what kind of drove the Americans so crazy. And the fact that the French didn't really seem to understand that this would offend anyone, like, really surprises me. But
yeah, I think the Americans' perspective was certainly, hey, we came here to discuss things that we thought were problems for both of us.
Yeah.
That both of us would equally have an interest in resolving, and resolving quickly, because you have your own problems, France. You know, why have anything additional with us? I thought we were cool. Essentially, they were coming here to try to clear up what they thought were misunderstandings.
Yeah.
And Talleyrand badly misjudged the situation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we were talking a little bit beforehand about, before we started doing this episode, how basically the Americans thought maybe they were dealing with the same France that they had dealt with during the War of Independence. I mean, the court of Louis the 16th was by no means, like, saintly, but it was certainly better organized than the kind of turmoil that they now had to deal with. And sure, the revolution and the age of terror was over, but the system it had left behind pretty much depended on bribes and money and less savory means to kind of keep going. I mean, the sham of democracy, as we'll discover, didn't last very long in this kind of atmosphere. And I think when the Americans went into France expecting to kind of have the same organized, respectable, honorable French system, they were rudely interrupted by the shock, really, that everything had kind of gone down the toilet. And the only way to advance things in France, if you're an outsider at least, is to use money. And it might sound obvious to us, but I suppose when the Americans were traveling there, they perhaps didn't anticipate that things could have gotten so bad, or that, on the other hand, things had become so different to what they had used to be.
Yeah, I think you alluded to it earlier a little bit. While they're there, right before they come to Paris, when they're kind of cooling their heels in the Netherlands, you know, the coup of 18 Fructidor occurs, and they learn of that. And, that's definitely an authoritarian lurch. Very much anti-democratic lurch for, the French Republic. And I think that certainly sets the tone for later coups. This introduces Bonaparte, to the higher levels of intrigue, within the government. But certainly that couldn't have been a settling thing for the Americans.
No, not at all.
But I don't think it prepared them at all for their reception.
No.
As I said earlier, Talleyrand definitely misplayed his hand, because he thought that there was this French party in the United States that was going to smooth everything over. And when Marshall's dispatches get back to the United States in 1798, and Adams announces that this mission failed, there's actually a huge Republican backlash blaming it on Adams.
Yeah, and, I thought that was hilarious.
And
yeah.
I think it's fantastic that Adams didn't release the dispatches right away.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
you know, Jefferson is writing to all his you know, Republican followers, you know, demand this. This is clearly a cover up. So they all yeah. demand it in righteous indignation. And then when it comes out, they're absolutely embarrassed.
Yeah.
And for the next 2 years, the Federalists just dominate the federal elections, even yeah. in the South. And it puts them on a very different footing than they'd been previously. Suddenly, money's available for armies. I think the phrase millions for defense, but not a penny for tribute, gets thrown out there in the U.S. Congress. Armies yeah. are raised. Frigates are authorized to be built. Cutters that the Treasury Department owns are outfitted for privateer warfare.
Wow.
And, you know, the U.S. and the French slowly fall into the quasi-war.
Oh, yes.
Which I guess would have been completely unthinkable 5 years earlier.
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, they were having undeclared naval warfare with the mm-hmm. French in the yeah. Caribbean on the high seas.
It's such a dramatic change, isn't it? Even down, I thought that it was very symbolic, even down to the fact that in July 1798, the old Treaty of Alliance that really had kind of brought France and America so close together during the War of Independence, that was repudiated.
Officially then, repudiated. Yeah.
yeah. And then 2 days later, then you had an approval given for attacks on French ships by US ships, basically. I mean, that's crazy, really. It's a serious escalation of affairs.
Absolutely. And Washington is brought out of retirement again. To be the symbolic head of an army that the United States is raising and outfitting, really being run by Hamilton, who is by this point out of government and increasingly falling apart personally. And, you know, you could argue his judgment has just left him generally at this point in his career. But it feeds into more infighting because the Federalists increasingly lose their head. And all this power is going to their head. Delusions of grandeur, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
But obviously this culminates with the Alien and Sedition Acts.
I saw that, yeah.
domestically, and I've read indications that Adams wasn't necessarily for them,
mm-hmm.
but he certainly didn't veto them.
Yeah.
And I guess just a quick rundown. Basically, these laws are violations of the First Amendment. The Sedition Act basically says newspapers can't criticize elected officials unfairly. Yeah. What does that mean? You can use that language to arrest and persecute whoever you want to, whenever you want to. And it's definitely used against Republican newspapers. People like Benjamin Franklin Bach, who is the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, has a newspaper sure. in Philadelphia. And James Callender, who, you know, was at one point personally employed by Thomas Jefferson to attack the Washington administration.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's definitely the arrests are pointed. And the Alien Enemies Act is also a very pointed law. Obviously, it comes from a paranoid place where the French Revolution is seen as this international conspiracy. And, you know, immigrants coming to the United States generally line up with sympathy for the Republicans and the French.
Yeah.
And the goals of the French Revolution. It was never fully implemented, but the idea that it could be, you know, really is a shock to the public conscience. And when taken together, this is taking it a step too far. And this is how the Federalists in general will begin their decline as a party, to where in 14 years, they're gone.
Yeah,
they're just gone.
Dramatic, like really drastic. The fact that the politics could change so much on the ground in America. I mean, even I'd like to kind of maybe bravely pose this question. Do you think that there could be a comparison drawn between the Seditions and Aliens Act you mentioned there, insofar as it limited American freedoms, and the coup of the 18 fruit kit.
However, it's
that one. Do you think a comparison could be drawn between the two of those? And you said that the American equivalent came from a kind of paranoid place. I mean, certainly the French reasons for doing so in their coup, it was effectively to limit the progress and basically exile the monarchist parties within the Council of 500. And the Directory was very much for this, and it really did lead down the road to a kind of despotic kind of aura existing or hanging over the French Republic that really enabled Napoleon, I think, to move in there in 1899, or 1799, rather.
I think that's a stretch. You know, when you compare the actual facts of the 18 Fructidor and the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, when you look at it, so 18 Fructidor basically removes two of the five members of the Directory who are not in line with the other three and cancels the results of elections.
Yeah.
You know, this is saying that if we don't like what you're printing, we're going to arrest you.
Yeah.
You know, which isn't by any means good, but I don't think it's on the same level. And also when it's about trying to, I guess, round up what the government would see as undesirables removing people who are could be seen as fomenters of insurrection or trouble. Now, obviously, I think you get into the prejudices of the people enforcing the law there, and that's problematic. But I don't see it necessarily as a Federalist coup attempt.
Okay.
And, you know, these laws were passed with sunset clauses. I don't know if that really matters. Because basically when Jefferson is elected in 1800, he just lets them expire.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So I think it seemed to be more tailored to a specific situation.
Yeah.
I think the Federalists, when they passed it, also had an eye towards if we lose the election, we don't want this being put on us. So let's limit it in time. In case we lose in 1800.
Right.
And that's certainly what happened.
Yeah, I agree that obviously the French coup was far more severe. I mean, you couldn't even call the American equivalent a coup, but I think it's interesting even saying that on two different sides of the world, really, you had circumstances which led their governments to do quite extreme things. And certainly in the French case, they had dramatic implications for the future of the French Republic. And I think it's really interesting to kind of, as you quite aptly demonstrated there, the two circumstances are very different. But I think it's fun sometimes to compare things because it helps you kind of pick out things and pick out more kind of issues that you wouldn't necessarily see if you were just looking at the American example, say, by itself. I mean, in terms of like motivations, say for the American side, why did they feel at that very moment that it was necessary to limit people's like freedoms of speech or say do the kind of things that they did? I mean, surely that you couldn't argue they were under the kind of threats that France believed it was under.
I think there was a paranoia that there was going to be a pro-French uprising. I also think it wasn't clear to Americans that Britain would hold out. And, you know, the way that the French had mopped up Europe, you know, could conceivably be construed that Britain's going to fall and then France is coming here. You know, so I think they had an imperfect view of the situation that hindsight's given us. And I also think there was a bit about hoping to win the next election behind the passage of those laws.
Sure.
But you had mentioned when it came to the coup of 18 Fructidor that it had real significant consequences for the future of France and really the future of Europe. But what is the similarity that I'll allow between the Alien and Sedition Acts and the coup of 18 Fructidor is it resulted in the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions being drawn up by Jefferson and Madison, though they were private citizens. What this introduces, are you familiar with these?
Not especially, no, okay. If I'm honest.
So what these introduce into the American dialogue in two separate arguments that are endorsed by state legislatures is the idea that the states are arbiters of what is constitutional. and that the state can effectively nullify a federal law that it finds unconstitutional. Obviously, this podcast's subject, John Marshall, will expressly reject that in rulings. But it puts a seed out there that'll resurface in the United States periodically and becomes the basis for secession. The Hartford Convention in New England will use them during the War of 1812 to talk about seceding from the Union.
Wow.
South Carolina in the 1830s will protest the Tariff of Abominations passed by the federal government and threaten to nullify that law, which will result in President Jackson threatening to march an army down there and hang every damn secessionist. and obviously that doesn't culminate in anything. But then ultimately this thinking is again present in 1860 when the United States actually has states secede from the Union and results in the Civil War. So intellectually, you could draw a line back to the Alien and Sedition Acts and the Republican reaction to them as laying the ideological foundations for the United States Civil War.
Wow. I never thought. I mean, I was actually planning to ask, do you think there are any major implications for the kind of Sedition Acts or these kind of events, even at this earliest stage? And yes, I touched on the coup there as having dramatic ones in France, but even just to think that the Civil War history itself goes so far back, I mean, wow, that's pretty profound there, Tom Daly. Good job.
It's what I do.
How about we move on to just the fact that the Americans were so resistant to really kind of play into the French demands for money, and do you think that that fact alone can be blamed on it failing, or do you think that the XYZ affair may not have resulted in the quasi-war that it did had the Americans been more willing to play a monetary ball, if you will?
I think that's a really complicated question. You know, the United States at this point is a little prudish, I want to say. And this might be some of the puritanical, you know, origins of it, but civic virtue and the idea of civic virtue is a very powerful thing in particularly the early United States. So I don't think they really had the option to accept the French demands. You know, I think they were very cognizant that it would be a dishonor to them personally and to the honor of the United States.
Yeah.
Because even when you look at the War of 1812, that is predicated by the slights to American honor that's transpiring on the high seas. And it's pushed by Westerners. People like Henry Clay, who were just elected to Congress, pushes that. The young war hawks. Not the people who live in Massachusetts on the coast, who probably have relatives being impressed. It's that young Western influx of new members to Congress that will force Madison's hand to declare war.
Yeah.
So I think Americans were too conscious of questions of honor to ever realistically have given in to those types of what they would see as corruptions by Taliban. Sure.
I liked what you said there about the idea of national honor coming into it. And this plays very conveniently into my dissertation and everything else about national honor I've talked about before. But with even when the worst details of the affair hadn't yet become known, in the fact that the dispatches hadn't yet been released, there were still members in the cabinet in the United States that were calling for war. I think the Attorney General and the Secretary of State for War actually were not agitating, I suppose is the wrong word, but they were certainly of the opinion that the French offences against the United States were such that they could be construed as offensive enough really to justify war. I mean, obviously there was too much division in the cabinet at that stage to kind of go towards a war, but it's still interesting to observe.
I think so, and I'll take it a step further. I think President Adams deserves an incredible amount of credit for the political bravery not to get into a war over this issue. And it cost him a second election. Him choosing to send additional delegates after the XYZ affair, and to hold out until the last minute for peace, and not to get into a war that he also believed would be disastrous for the United States, is an incredible feat of courage. And it's because he chose to send that second delegation, instead of pursuing the easier path of war,
absolutely,
that the Convention of 1800 was able to happen, once the French had undergone another change of government. Which Zach detailed in great depth in the Agora Podcast Network's Washington v. Bonaparte episode, where he, in detail, goes over the coup of 18 Brumaire. So I encourage you to check that out if you want to know more about that change.
Handy plug.
Yes, very handy. But anyway, that allows for the Convention of 1800 to take place and the Treaty of Mortefontaine.
Good job.
That sound? Yeah.
I think it's Morfontaine. I don't know if you're supposed to pronounce. I'm just so dire at French pronunciation. But yeah, the what I prefer to call the Convention of 1800, because then I don't have to pronounce the actual name of the treaty. Mm-hmm. But I agree. I mean, had John Adams not really gone that direction, imagine, and we're entering Jordan Harbor territory, as I like to call it now, because this would be best reserved for the Twilight Histories podcast. All this speculation, but it's fun to think how American history would have gone had John Adams not elected to try diplomacy one more time, and had he really just elected to let it fail and really joined, if you like, another coalition against France.
Yeah, so would you say that this is an example of diplomacy not failing?
I would say so, yeah. But, I mean, is the quasi-war really a success? It is in the fact that it wasn't a genuine open war. I mean, I suppose you could call it a kind of draw for diplomacy, if that's even allowed, insofar as a quasi-war resulted, but a war did not result, if that makes sense.
It does.
Another point I'd like to make about the Convention of 1800, and this might seem a little bit tenuous, but I think it's worth mentioning, even just for kind of, like, analysis sake, the fact that once the Convention of 1800 happened, it kind of nullified peacefully, that is, the Treaty of Alliance that France and America had had. Once that had happened, there was no real sense about how American history was going to go. But we know now that this space of time now, there'll be 150 years before America has a proper Treaty of Alliance with any country. And that will take the form in the Second World War with the Allies of Great Britain and the Soviet Union. So I think it's a really interesting observation to make, that even at this early stage, I suppose you couldn't say that the rest of American history is being established, but certainly the history of America and foreign policy with respect to isolationism and the Monroe Doctrine and that kind of thing, it's certainly set on a certain path by the fact that it ends its foreign ties, essentially, at least the more concrete ones, and American diplomats are kind of happy to, while they continue the representation abroad, they're happy to continue without any real complete ties to the countries that they are actually representing America in. Any thoughts on that, Tom?
I think that's a pretty astute observation, and it certainly fits in with the pattern that Washington put forth in the Neutrality Proclamation through his exhortations in his farewell address. About the dangers of entangling alliances, that does go, as you point out, through the Monroe Doctrine, even through the United States Senate's refusal to ratify the Treaty of Versailles in World War I,
yeah,
and choosing not to be part of the League of Nations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all that fits, pretty neatly within an arc that this example, demonstrates.
Mm-hmm. So to those people that may not know of the XYZ affair and may claim to know, or at least believe that they know a good deal about American foreign policy as a history, what would you say to them? Would you say XYZ is a vital ingredient in American foreign policy?
I would say that it certainly deserves more of a discussion,
yeah,
than the literal two lines I got in my high school textbook about an American delegation, not naming future Chief Justice John Marshall as a member, mentioning the letters X, Y, and Z and then moving on. It certainly deserves more attention than that.
Yeah.
But I think any serious student of the United States history needs to be more aware of it and where it fits in the continuum of that history and the implications that it has.
Is there any parts of it particularly that really, well, I suppose number one, that you found the most interesting if you're able to round it down that much, and number two, that most kind of, I suppose, grinded your gears the most?
I think for both, the real thing that I took away from it was just how people could get so caught up in a moment that clearly mutually beneficial actions could be put to the side.
Yeah.
Like, it was so in the interests of the United States and so in the interests of Directory France to come to a quick and easy and neat solution that it really boggles the mind that it devolved in the way that it did.
Mm.
You know, it's rather shocking to the conscience even today for me. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lesson there if I wanted to be moralizing that could be extrapolated. But
I think certainly all throughout history, the idea that personal relationships get in the way of proper diplomacy, and within those personal relationships, the idea of egos and one's own national interest, I suppose, can often be put above the greater good.
That's very well put. And I think with that, Mr. Zach Twomley, I would like to thank you for help making American Biography's one-year anniversary so special.
Oh.
And for joining us.
Well, I would like to thank you very much for having me, and having just celebrated your first birthday with much alcohol and lots of cake, I would like to wish you the very best and many more happy years into the future.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Zach. Now, Zach, I know you're a humble guy and don't really like doing plugs, but would you maybe want to let my listeners know a little bit about your show in case they don't?
Well, you know, I was thinking of not doing any of these plugs, but I suppose since you've pressed me into doing them, just as Americans were once pressed into British ships, I will do my very best to plug my show as best as I can. So, as most listeners of When Diplomacy Fails will know, the best way to help When Diplomacy Fails is through BeFit, so blog, email, Facebook, iTunes, and telling people. I'd especially like to plug the blog because I'm going to Cambridge, whether people like it or not, and I do need a lot of money for that. So if anyone has any spare books in their pocket they'd like to send my way, I would really, really appreciate it. And I promise to send you a super nice email afterwards thanking you. So if you go to wdfpodcast.blogspot.ie, click on the glorious donate button in the right corner and make me very happy. Thank you very much.
Very good. Well, everybody, thank you so much for listening today, and I hope you enjoyed this more informal than usual celebratory episode. And I hope you'll remember to check out AmericanBiography.webs.com for updates on the show, and follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at American_bio. And if you have any questions or concerns, as always, please shoot me an email at AmericanBiographyPodcast@gmail.com. So until next time, thanks for listening, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Very good.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.